Whenever your attention is pulled away from the breath, and you become lost in thought or a fantasy or a dream about the future or the past, that moment when you're aware that your attention strayed, that's actually a moment of mindfulness. And so you really gently notice that your attention strayed, and you bring it back to the feeling of the breath at the tip of the nostril, above the upper lip, into the rise and fall of the chest, or the stretching and releasing of your abdomen. Wherever your attention is, see if you can follow just one breath. From start to finish. You might notice very strong thoughts, disturbing energies in the body, emotions, things you know might go through your head. You might be compelled to move. Whatever those things are that take you away from the breath, you might just make a note of that. And gently return to the sensation of the breath. Watching the breath like it's the most interesting thing in the world. Because it's what's happening right now, right here. See if you can catch the beginning of a breath as you start to breathe in and know you're breathing in. You might notice a slight pause at the top of the breath before your natural exhale, and you know you're breathing out. And at the bottom of the breath, again, you might notice a slight pause in your respiration. See if you can follow just one breath. Sometimes we might not sense our bodies or the breath strongly enough to feel it. This doesn't matter. As long as when you're breathing in, you know you're breathing in. And when you're breathing out, you're aware you're breathing out. Whenever your mind wanders and you notice that, with as much friendliness and acceptance as you can muster, just very gently return your attention to the breath. For the next part of our meditation, I'm going to invite everybody to open up their ears to the world of hearing. So we're moving our focus away from the sensation of the breath to things we can hear. So go ahead and find a sound and try and just be a witness to that sound without labeling it or judging it. Go ahead and listen in a little closer and see if you can find another sound. And follow that sound as a witness. Go ahead and let that sound go and listen in again to another sound. Whenever your mind gets lost in thought, just bring your awareness back to the sounds you can hear. Let's go ahead and move our awareness back to the center of our chest. Just noticing your breath at a natural rate. Let's all go ahead and take a nice long inhale through our nose and hold it at the top. Fill in the belly and lungs with air. And a long, slow exhale through the mouth. Every time we exhale is an opportunity to release to release tension from our bodies, to feel a release on the inside. Let's go ahead and do that inhale one more time, nice and deep through the nose, holding at the top. And a long, slow exhale through the mouth, releasing any tension that's available. Just allowing ourselves to soften and relax into that out-breath. Now, I'm going to take everybody on a systematic journey through the body. I'm going to be naming a different body part. And I want you to picture that body part in your mind's eye. And just notice any physical sensations you feel on that body part. Not trying to push anything away or become too attached to the sensations that feel good. Just trying to notice what's there. So let's all go ahead and bring our awareness to the top of our head, noticing any sensations in the top of our head. Moving down into the forehead, and your eyes. Feeling your eyeballs deep in their sockets. Moving into the nose. And the upper lip. And feel inside of your mouth. And moving over to the cheeks and jaw. Let's do the sides of our head. And the back of our head. Let's move down now into the neck and throat. Just allowing ourselves to experience what's there. And moving down into the chest. If you're holding any tension, you might allow that to soften. Moving down into the abdomen. Just feeling the abdomen from the inside. Let's go around now and feel that skin along the back. Maybe noticing all the points, the chairs touching your back. Let's go ahead and move into the arms and the shoulders. Notice the front of your shoulders and the back of your shoulders and the whole of both shoulders. Let's move down now into your upper arms, your biceps and triceps. Let's feel them hanging off of your body. All sensation. And you might come upon an area that has very little sensation or a lot of sensation. Pay no attention to that. Just notice what's there. Let's go ahead and move down onto our forearms. Notice the palm of your hands. The back of your hands, and even your fingers. Go ahead and feel both of your arms together. Let's go ahead and just notice our buttocks sitting on the chair. In the back of our thighs. And just moving down to the calves now. Really giving our legs a break from the world of walking, standing. Let's move down now into the heels and the sides of the feet. Notice the bottoms of the feet. And the tops of the feet. And even your toes. Let's go ahead and move up into our shins. And knees. Notice the tops of your thighs. Go ahead and feel both legs together. Go ahead and feel your whole body sitting in the chair. Your whole body sitting in the chair. Anytime you get lost in thought or distracted, or a disturbing energy arises that's hard to tolerate, once you're ready and you notice that, you might just bring your attention back to the sound of my voice and the instructions. But at any time, you can just start to focus on the breath. Now, in this space of silence, let's do a loving kindness practice. And when we do a loving kindness practice, it starts with us. We bring into our minds ourselves, and we might send ourselves the wishes of, may you be well, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. Noticing that when we bring compassion to ourselves, first, allows us to soften and enter the stream of life more skillfully with others. And may you be well, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. And now, below the level of that regular wishes we wish for ourselves, I want to invite you to try something a little different, which would be to really think about what you would want to hear right now, or what you need to hear for yourself. May I be open? May I be in the present moment. May I love others from a place of stability. Whatever those things are for you, I just want to give you a little time to craft that and send yourself those wishes. May I X, may I Y, may I Z. Now we can widen that circle of compassion, bringing into our hearts and minds someone close to us, someone we care about very much. We might send them the wishes, may you be well, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. Noticing the way it feels to say those words. And not letting go of being able to feel or cultivate anything other than what you're feeling right now. This is more about the effort than the outcome. And so just like we did for ourselves, you might think of this person you care about very much and kind of know what they need or would like to hear or, you know, kind of your highest intention for them. May you know what you need. May you get what you need. May you be well, happy, and peaceful. So I'm just going to give everyone a few seconds to come up with that language and go ahead and send that to the person you care about. Let's widen out our circle of compassion even further. To someone we might see on a regular basis but don't know very well, someone we might just feel more neutral about. And just noticing them and sending them loving kindness. May you be well. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. Now let's go ahead and just widen that out even further to all sentient beings that we share this planet with. People who are experiencing joy and happiness and illness and sickness and death. People are affected by wars and natural disasters and births and joyful birthdays. Let's just hold it all. May you be well. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be well. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. Would you please open up your chanting books to My Wish on page 11? May I become at all times, both now and forever, a protector for those without protection. A guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with an ocean to cross, sanctuary for those in danger, a lamp for those without light, a place of refuge for those who lack shelter, and a servant to all in need. By means of this meritorious deed, may I never join with the unwise, only the wise, until the time I attain nirvana. Hi, good evening, everybody, and welcome. And happy Memorial Day. You know, I was given the opportunity to do this talk a while ago, and I got a text like, hey, which date would you prefer? You know, Memorial Day, or I think it was like, one of these Wednesdays coming up. And, you know, my initial reaction is to kind of like want to take that Wednesday, right, that might be just down the road a little bit farther, or not be about a topic that's kind of just so near and dear to my heart, you know, both personally and professionally, which is Memorial Day, you know, and it's a day of remembrance and reverence, and it's also a day where we have a lot of fun traditionally as Americans, you know, so it's this interesting kind of duality that we all get the opportunity to experience on Memorial Day. And for people like me who served in the Marine Corps, in the infantry, and went to war and lost friends, and came back, you know, changed to a world that didn't seem to know about those experiences, today is a day of reflection a lot of the times, but I also try and have fun because I've really learned over the past 20 plus years that I have this type of thinking like, hey, I think the guys I served with who aren't here, you know, they would want me to have a good time. You know, they'd want me to have fun. But, you know, I think they would also approve if I'm a little bit sad and touched by their loss. You know, because it really, you know, just shows all the love that was there for my brothers, you know. And I say brothers because I served in the Marine Corps at a time where women weren't yet in the infantry. And it's so wonderful that we've been able to change as a society and kind of like have more acceptance of the genders throughout all combat experiences that are available to people. But that wasn't my experience, so forgive me. That just so you understand the context when I'm talking, if I'm a little bit more gender specific. And so, you know, the war is inherently dehumanizing. And, you know, the people who I used to consider my enemies, you know, I've had to learn to really see their bravery, see their sacrifice, see them as full people who had families, who experienced birth and joy and birthdays, had inside jokes with their friends, you know, experienced sickness and death. You know, they struggled and had joy, full human beings. And, you know, it's taken me a long time to kind of get there because the mental conditioning that allows somebody to go to combat and overcome their natural aversion to harming other people also kind of makes it so empathy and those types of things for the other side, the other, you know, it's not very adaptive. Doesn't really have its place there. And so, you know, I've had to really work on not only rehumanizing myself, but helping other people rehumanize themselves after going through these experiences. And I want to really connect this to everybody too, because we all are conditioned from birth in a family, in a culture, on teams, in schools, and we go through experiences that condition us, condition reactions in us, and thoughts and feelings and stress responses that, you know, can just really stick with us long after we leave those places. And so really what I'm proposing is that this is an extreme example of mental conditioning that I went through, but we all go through this in one way or another throughout our lives, you know. And once you've left a place, you know, and you're ready to heal, you know, Buddhism offers a very clear path to being present, to having compassion for those parts of ourselves that had to go through those tough experiences. And I'm going to get into that a lot tonight. And I like to tell this story kind of like, you know, imagine you're in the woods and you see a dog by a tree. And, you know, you go over and you kind of pet the sweet dog, and all of a sudden it lunges at you growling with its fangs bared, you know. And you go from being kind of like ready to pet this sweet dog to jumping back and like angry and scared that this dog, you know, wants to hurt you. And then you notice that under a pile of leaves, the dog's leg is caught in a trap. And then you just switch back from being angry and scared and protecting yourself to all of a sudden having more compassion for this dog. You know, you can see that it's being affected by something outside of its control. And so all of a sudden you get your compassion back, right? Caring compassion for this animal that's suffering. And here's the thing, you know, all of our legs are caught in a trap in one way or another. And, you know, if we can see that, see where our legs caught in the trap and validate that and say, oh my gosh, like, people think, what's wrong with me when they're suffering? But really, I always ask, well, what happened to you? Because once I can understand the context and the story, it all makes sense. You know, our suffering makes sense. And there's a way out of it, and Buddhism gives us a very clear way out of it. And so not only can we see that our leg's caught in a trap, but everyone we're talking to's leg is caught in a trap in one way or another, you know, but in our fear and in our delusion, we can't see that, and we're just reacting. And so I'm going to get into a little bit more about that too, but I want to just get into a little just quick thing about Buddhism and war and violence. You know, it's kind of fascinating to me to read a little bit about the Buddha, and there's so much about Buddhism. Like, it was interesting. I read that it's kind of like, there's no like one book that defines Buddhism. Like, the Christians have the Bible, but Buddhists have this like library, right? And there's all these schools of Buddhism depending on what country you go to, and then there's all this knowledge base, and the knowledge base is built on over the centuries by translators of the knowledge. And so it's kind of just built and built and built up to where it's at now. And in the West, we kind of have, you know, a little bit different of a bent on Buddhism. You know, we strip away a lot of the supernatural stuff and just kind of come up with the things that work as a spiritual practice in a lot of ways. Things that are effective and helpful. But that's not Buddhism everywhere, right? Buddhism in the United States is seen as a very peaceful thing. You know, it's and I think that reputation's well earned in the United States. But in other countries, you know, Buddhists go to war. You know, think about Japan in World War II, Zen Buddhists. You know, there's been ethnic cleansings, the Sri Lankan Civil War. You know, there's all these Buddhists that have to go to war. And most Buddhist philosophers kind of think, okay, well, war is a product of greed, hatred, and delusion, right? Which is aversion, craving, and ignorance. And so when we make somebody the other, right, that's kind of coming from a place of delusion. But basically, Buddha lived before there was any kind of like organized thought about the human collective. You know, so there wasn't anything like systemic happening. It was more like, okay, how can we purify your mind? How can we help you suffer less? And the Buddha actually like counseled kings and did all the, you know, he was involved politically, but he didn't have like an agenda. He didn't have any political philosophy. But he did practice nonviolence. And you know, really what I came away with is nonviolence as a practice is just the awareness that violence doesn't improve our state of mind. You know, when I have a sharp word with somebody, or, you know, I physically harm somebody, verbally harm somebody. It just doesn't improve my state of mind. And that's not just with the other, that's with myself too, right? When I have reactions where I'm full of self-loathing or self-hatred, you know, that too is violence, right? I have violent thoughts. And I'm not talking even extreme end, you know. I'm just thinking about how hard we are on ourselves. You know, how hard I've been on myself historically, you know, before I learned kind of like where that conditioning comes from. You know, it's like it's all conditioned. You know, babies aren't born with thoughts, just a bundle of sensations. You know, all these like thoughts and reactions in many ways are conditioned into us. And so really the Buddha wanted to know, hey, if you go to war, can you do it more out of like the love for the people you are trying to protect versus, you know, the hatred of the other people? You know, and because that, you know, what is the intention and effort behind your actions, essentially? You know, you're motivated by love or fear. And you know, right now we're in a social and political climate that really invites dehumanization, hatred, fear of the other. You know, and dehumanization is really depriving people of their positive human qualities. And, you know, I was watching Full Metal Jacket with Tyler last night, and it was so awesome getting to watch that movie about the Marine Corps again, kind of like from this perspective of somebody who feels like he's recovered a lot from the Marine Corps. And when I say recovered from the Marine Corps, I mean I've become aware of the mental conditioning that, you know, propels my behavior and thoughts and feelings, and I've unwound a lot of that, you know, the unhelpful stuff. And so, watching that movie last night, you could clearly see in boot camp, you're basically told that everything that came before that is wrong, and that you are kind of like this worthless piece of pond scum who, you know, can't even tie their shoes. And then you're completely broken down and reconditioned to be a Marine, you know? And, you know, funny joke in the Marine Corps, like there's not a lot of place for your humanness a lot of the times. I used to joke like, oh, if the Marine Corps wanted me to have feelings, they would have issued me some. You know, because there's just not a lot of space for, you know, for my preferences and things like that. And so the dehumanization process is really losing your civilian identity and being built back into a different image. And, you know, in the face of a very powerful system, you know, that reinforces certain things, you know, like violence and aggression, and teamwork, right, and integrity, and courage, and so many wonderful qualities, right? There's so many parts of being a Marine that I still use. You know, it's given me so much courage. You know, I got so many guts because of it. But all this reinforcement goes in through all kinds of things. You know, shooting rifles to the cadence you sing when you're running about hurting other people and who they are. And interestingly enough, like the military didn't used to be quite this way. But in after World War II, they did this study and they found that a really low percentage of infantrymen were firing their weapon at the enemy. And they were like, okay, well, this isn't good. You know, it's a good thing we won, but there's some things we need to improve on. And so they created a whole new training, which is basically to train how you fight, you know, and you're kind of like doing things, you know, shooting at targets that look like people, doing things to overcome that natural aversion we have to, you know, to hurting each other. And so through that, you know, you're really able to get this solid other in your mind and know that there's just nothing more honorable than going to fight the enemy. And so, you know, it's like back then, right, in 2002, 2001 through 2003, the climate in our country is a lot different. You know, there's a bugle being sounded for war and everybody was getting on board, you know. And so even just culturally, we all kind of went there. And, you know, people's tax dollars support that, you know, and there's just people participate maybe even more than they know. But the problem is that after you go to war and come back, it was really nice being sent off by all you guys. Thank you so much. You got me so fired up to go. And I was so happy to do that, right? And it was like, it was almost like you feel like, it's conditioned into you as a Marine that you're cut above the rest. You're different than everybody else, and better in some ways than you nasty civilians. That's what they taught us, you know? But there's no process of returning, right? How do you rehumanize yourself and other people after you get back from an experience like that? You know, the mental conditioning that takes place at war is different than the mental conditioning that takes place in boot camp, you know? And so the mental conditioning in war is a lot of hypervigilance and kind of fear and boredom and all of these things that you're not really sure what's around the next corner, but you know what? I'll go find out. You know, it's just this attitude of, you know, I gave myself over to something bigger than myself, and I was totally willing to die for it. You know, and that feels scary to even say it, because it's like, man, you come pretty close a lot of the times, and those things stick with you, you know, and so coming back from an experience like that, you're on edge, and it's not just me that's experiencing this, right? It's like everyone around me. We can't sleep, we're on edge. A lot of us have reverse culture shock. We couldn't even really go out in the community and feel settled down at all. You know, you'd hear a motorcycle rev its engine, you're on the ground. Someone threw a snap pot by my head one time, and I just body slammed him before I even knew what had happened. You know, it's just real quick. You're ready to go, you know, and so the Marine Corps can cultivate all this aggression and violence, right? But as human beings, it's very Buddhist and okay, well, where there's aggression and violence and fear and hate, there's got to be the opposite of that too, right? Peace, love, equanimity, joy, gratitude. But there was no avenue of cultivating those things, you know, once you get back from experience like that. And plus your mindset says, oh, to admit that anything is wrong or that I'm affected in any way would mean that I'm weak, right? And that has no place. And so you have to overcome a lot of natural things, a lot of conditioning in order to even start to heal. And our society, our culture, doesn't really allow for a more welcome home experience. Native Americans, when they would go fight, they would send their braves off to battle, but when they'd come home, you know, they would have purification ceremonies. They would all get together so the rest of the people could hear about, you know, what they went through in battle. Because those Indians knew that they had a vested interest in that. They are me and I am them, you know. And we just don't have that. Less than 1% of the population serves in the military. You know, even a lower percentage actually goes to war and sees combat these days. You know, it's not something that's really common. So you come back and you're having all these experiences, right, at being triggered, things like that. And really that means my body's amazing because it can sense danger. And it's like, okay, don't go through that again. You know, here's a motorcycle rev its engine and my body will get confused and think, oh, I must be getting shot at, right? Thank you, body. That's so amazing that you're protecting me, but I don't need that protection right now, right? I'm trying to go to the nightclub, you know, or whatever it was. And I'm talking 20 years ago. And so, you know, I kept getting stuck, right? Like it was hard to, when your stress system gets habituated to all that stress, you know, you're just always feeling stressed and anxious. And so, you know, my journey back to myself, back to my heart, wasn't linear. It wasn't like, okay, I'm gonna get better and do these things. And man, look at me. I'm giving a Dharma talk on how good I feel, right? No, it's a path, and it's fraught with confusion and self-will and, you know, aversion to admitting anything's wrong or to feeling things. I mean, it's really hard. It's hard to get better. But, you know, I ran into people along the way that created those conditions. And then along the way, I found Buddhism, you know. And a lot of our modern psychotherapies are really based on Buddhism and Buddhist principles. And so, you know, meditation and compassion are really what helped me get unstuck. And so basically, you know, going through these experiences and doing what I could to feel better, right? And some of those things were, you know, addiction, you know, and so that's one way I, you know, tried to take care of my stress, and it just makes sense, like something to just calm everything down, you know, but that only works so long before it just doesn't work anymore very well. And so that's what I mean by I get stuck. You know, people think they're broken, but I just think people get stuck, you know, and I needed to find the things that would unstick myself. But not only unstick myself now, but the things that would allow me to keep unsticking myself. And so I started meditating, I think, in around 2012. And I was just introduced to it at like some different treatment centers, maybe even the VA once or twice. And I did it, and I was like, man, I felt really relaxed. And I felt almost like slightly euphoric. You know, it's just like, I even remember the person who led me in the meditation. Her voice was like an angel. She's like, it was the most amazing meditation voice. And I was just like, it was a really profound experience, you know. And I was like, okay, that'll be cool. Maybe they think we did it like weekly. So I was like, oh, next Wednesday I get to do that again. Awesome. You know, and then I slowly started kind of just meditating on my own and finding guided meditations. And a lot of that was just to develop samadhi, right? To calm down and feel peaceful. And then I would go into the world and feel unpeaceful again. And so I, you know, started a meditation practice. And, you know, that essentially, I kept going with that. I'm somebody who's got like more. I like more, right? And I'm a little intense too. So when I start doing something, I like doing it, I'm going to do it pretty intensely. So I started doing that with meditation, right? And there's worse things to be dependent on than meditation, trust me. And starting a meditation practice led to me going to like a, you know, like a 10-day silent meditation retreat. I meditated for 10 days, and I hated almost every minute of it, actually. You know, I just wanted to leave, just seeing every rotten thing I'd done, right? I felt bad about my whole life just constantly playing through my head, but you're just sitting there meditating through that. And, you know, by the end of that, I was starting to feel peaceful, and I'd never felt peace like that. But, of course, me being me, you know, those are states I want to cling on to, right? Oh, peaceful, yeah, I'm going to feel peaceful. And honestly, when I got back, I was so peaceful for about a month. Like, I think week two after being back, I was like, I didn't feel any negative feeling. I was like, am I enlightened? Oh, shit. Don't tell anybody. Like, I was just like, shut your mouth and just keep meditating and play it cool, right? Because I was like, I don't know, because I never felt a peace like that. And it's actually pretty funny now, but, you know, eventually that went away, right? And then I got to just fully experience myself racked by suffering again. You know, and I think that's one of our biggest delusions is the fact that somehow suffering is going to end. I think we're going to get really a lot more skillful at dealing with our suffering and seeing where our legs caught in the trap, you know, and being able to respond to that with understanding and compassion. Like, so many of us are so good at giving other people what they need and knowing the right thing to say to somebody. But when it comes to ourselves, you know, we treat ourselves pretty poorly. You know, and so we might start to think about, huh, if a friend was going through what I'm going through right now, what would I tell him? Huh. Okay, I can think like that. Okay, I can think outside of myself. Okay. What do I need right now? Okay. Yeah, I think I just need to sit quietly. Okay, I'm going to do that. Okay. Does my suffering, does what happening right now, is what is going on inside of me right now, does it make sense to me given what I know about myself and what I've been through? Okay, it makes sense. Okay, I'm feeling angry, I'm out of sorts, this and that. It makes sense. I just went through X, Y, and Z. I have a history of these things happening to me and they affect me deeply. Right? It's validating our experience. It's seeing our leg caught in the trap. And that's really the first step, right? Is just seeing where your leg's caught in the trap, validating that, and then figuring out what you need and giving that to yourself with self-compassion. Right? And there's so many little tips and tricks and hints on how to think compassionately and practice self-compassion. But that one about thinking about, okay, what would I tell a friend who's going through what I'm going through? That's a really effective one. You know, and hey, we're not alone in our suffering. Right? I don't ever have to feel alone in my suffering anymore, because I just think of all the people who have gone through the things that I've gone through. Right? There's so many of me. I'm not special at all. I'm unique, but I'm not special. I'm not a victim, and I'm not alone, and neither are any of you. And so once we can start to recognize the common humanity in our suffering, and that other people go through what we go through, and we're not alone, and there's nothing wrong with us, but something happened to us, you know, we can just start to like kind of give ourselves the space we need to feel, you know. And for those of us who have had like past difficult relationships with parents or caregivers, you know, getting that space to feel is huge, right? Even giving yourself permission to feel. You know, because we just tend to internalize so much of our early experience. You know, and finding, rehumanizing ourselves, seeing our leg in the trap, validating, and really, we're using this with mindfulness, you know, our awareness. What's happening inside of me right now? What do I need to do to respond to this? And also in that, recognizing impermanence. You know, my internal weather is constantly changing, constantly. What I'm feeling right now, I'm probably not going to be feeling at some point soon. It doesn't have to stick around. It doesn't. And how much am I adding to it to make my suffering last longer? You know, there's my suffering, and then there's all the things I do to make myself suffer more. And I know I got a list of them. You know, but that's the idea, is when you give yourself that space, you can start to see your list and start to see how you interfere with processing something and moving through it so you can be more present, authentic version of yourself. And so self-compassion and meditation are two practices that have really helped me recover from my experiences in the military, my experiences in this culture, my experiences in my family, my experiences in my peer group growing up, all of these things that condition me mentally and kind of caused me to lose sight of my own humanity and continue to do so. And that's why it's a practice. We're never perfect at it. We just keep practicing, right? And without the idea that we're somehow going to master it. But we're going to think that too. And then you just catch that and you're like, oh, I'm a silly little delusional human being. It's all good. You know, I'm just doing what everybody else does. And really cultivating the awareness that that you're my brothers and sisters, you know, and vice versa, and that we all need to take care of each other. And so you know, in closing, I just really want to recognize the people I served with who didn't make it back, and you know, the effects that war has had on their families and their friends and all the people who love them. and that grief is something that really we all feel and that unites us all, but as a culture, we just don't talk about it. You know, as a culture, it's something we feel a lot of aversion to, or it's socially not kind of comfortable to talk about those things. But I think it's important. You know, it's important to keep, you know, people alive as we see fit and as we need to, so we can feel healthy and we can feel like we're processing hurts that have happened to us, and so we can have access to the positive and loving effects that these people have had on our lives, the people who are no longer with us. Because when we cut ourselves off from the pain of grief, we also cut ourselves off from the prospect of feeling them in our hearts and continuing a spiritual relationship in some way with these people who are no longer with us. And I like to think that instead of kind of ghosts that haunt me, you know, I really have ancestors and people who are no longer with us that guide me. And so can you. And so can you. So, thank you so much for listening to my Dharma talk tonight. And thanks for letting me be here.